Sex Bob-omb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine episode, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Hey there, kids and Keebler Bits. Welcome back to another exciting episode of After Rot. And tonight we have got with us Kirk Lindo, the creator and publisher of Vampirous Luxura. I hope I pronounced that properly. And the Vampirotica line of comics and stuff. How's it going, Kirk?
Going well. And yeah, you did pronounce that pretty good. That's
Yay. I have to admit, I actually have one of those.
Oh, really? Okay. What do you have?
I can't remember. It was, I think, one of the Vampirotica issues that was... I also have a comic book store, so when I get comic book collections, I go, oh, hey, what's the cool stuff? It's like, okay, this one I can't put out like normal, but this one looks cool. I'll keep that one.
which is what just about everybody else did.
Yeah, well, yeah.
There's 50 issues of them out there, so, you know, I figured they'd get around eventually. So.
Well, that's good. So how did you get into doing comic... And, by the way, when did you start doing comic books?
Okay, I got into comics back in around 1990, 1991. I had gotten out of college. I went to the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan. And when I got out of school, there was literally nothing for me to do in comics because it was DC, Marvel, and pretty much nobody else around that time. And so I got into marketing. And I was a marketing director for a sportswear company because fortunately, while I was going to school, I also studied advertising and marketing. And one day, there was an ad in a newspaper that a friend told me about that said there was a company that was looking for comic artists. Now, anybody out there in the entire planet to see an advertisement in your local newspaper for comic artists is like... Is this a joke? Are you kidding me? This is impossible. But it was true, and it was this small company called Personality Comics.
I know that company.
Are you sure? They've published about a billion books, or should I say, I helped them publish about a billion books.
Well, and, excellent. They just released a new one this week too for Iron Maiden.
No, different company.
Different company.
No, Personality is no longer publishing, but this was way, way back then. And so, you know, I got out of work and, you know, grabbed my portfolio, went there, and the guys, guy by the name of Adam Post, he took a look at my work and, you know, he said, hey, this stuff looks good. I'd like to hire you to draw a comic. And the comic that he offered me to draw was a biography about Patrick Stewart, which at that time I was kind of like pinch me because I was a huge I'm a lifelong Star Trek fan, and that was just really, really great. And so, you know, they gave me the details, gave me the script, you know, looked over the contracts and stuff like that. And then while we were there, he said, hey, okay, I just want to ask you one thing. Why are you wearing a suit? I said, well, I'm just coming from my day job. I'm a marketing manager for a sportswear company, and I'm just coming in from work. And they were like, really? It's like, well, listen, we're looking for an editor. You know, if you have any management experience, you think you might want to become an editor also. So they literally hired me there on the spot to become an artist and an editor to help them grow the company.
See, and, the adage, dress for success.
Dress for success, yeah, yeah. You never know what'll happen. People will tend to take you a little more seriously, you know, depending on the situation.
Well, yeah. Now, I mean, nowadays you walk into a comic book company or whatever and say, hey, I'm going to do good stuff for you guys. You walk in with a suit to say, Marvel and DC are that way.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. It's like, it's a whole, by the way, the whole, you're talking about the Personality Press version for the Star Trek comic. That's funny because last year I sold a copy of that to somebody who was going to meet him at the local convention.
Yeah, well, if you have any of the original Personality comics, every one of them, open up the front cover, you'll see my name in there as either art editor, or eventually I became the editor in chief for the whole company.
And cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. It was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. I had a really good time. excuse me. I got to work with a lot of really, really cool people. We made some good comics. We made some bad comics, but you know,
I was good.
We made some good ones, too.
I was just going to say, you're talking the 90s. There was a lot of crap then.
Yeah. There was a lot. There definitely was.
Good sterling gems, but there was a lot of crap.
Yeah, it was the way it was. The funny part is though, you know, there's an opinion that I have about that.
Uh-oh.
And that is, I remember even Marvel had some just absolutely horrible books back then. I mean, I remember they were terrible. They know it. I mean, if anybody was around who was back then, they can open up, you could see. But
yep.
Somehow, you know, independents would get, you know, more of a bad rap if they put out a bad comic. Now, to me, if you're an independent, you're already on a shoestring budget, you do not get all of the perks that a Marvel or a DC has. You do not have the infinite amount of resources and capital that they have.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're independent, you know, okay, you put out a comic that's not absolutely stellar, there are legitimate reasons. But if you're Marvel frickin' Comics, you know, the number one comic company in America, you know, probably in the world, if not for someone from Japan, there's no excuse to make bad comics. And they did a lot of them back in the 90s. Good thing they're not doing that anymore.
Some people would disagree with you on the anymore.
Well, I'm talking about it's very rare today that you open up a Marvel comic and you just see horrible artwork. I would say the artwork is at an all-time high. Perhaps the writing, the storylines are not quite up to par. But the overall artwork in comics today is better than, I mean, I think it's better than it's ever been. You know, the talent is really incredible.
That I will agree with you 100%. The big news today is, you know, today is comic book day, right?
Of course, yeah.
Captain America number one, Steve Rogers. Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. Is it good? I haven't seen it.
No, it's horrible.
Oh, my God.
The artwork's fine, but the storyline, the concept starts off with, well, let me read you this, okay? Because I just happened to read it just a few minutes ago. While fighting his way through S.H.I.E.L.D.'s reality-bending small-town super prison, Pleasant Hill, an aged and depowered Steve Rogers was returned to fighting form by a sentient cosmic cube named Kobik.
Yeah, okay.
And that begins the comic book.
Yeah, not good.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, not good.
It's got to be a joke. I mean, yeah. If it was April 1st, I would have said, "Whoa, they're putting one on you, people, man. They're just throwing it on you."
Yeah, yeah. Well, hey, listen.
But hey,
tell. I mean, as time goes on, they either get better or the book will get canceled. I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's that simple. But getting back to your question of, you know, how I got started, I worked with Personality Comics for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, I kind of decided, you know, I had some ideas that I wanted to do, which kind of really didn't fit in with what they wanted to publish or what they wanted to do. So I decided to strike out on my own and started publishing my own stuff. And after about 6 months, I came up with the idea for Vampirotica. And, you know, published the first issue, and right from the very start, it was the best-selling book that I did at that time up until that point. And my first issue sold out of a first printing, sold out of a second printing. I had to go to a third printing, and we eventually sold that one out as well.
Nice.
My issue number two had a first and a second printing. And by the time I got to issue number three, we were doing well enough that I could overprint enough to satisfy the demand. And it just really, you know, it took off. It was in the height of, you know, the not the birth, but what I would say the solidification of the bad girl genre. And which, you know, remnants of it still exist today, which, you know, my Luxura was right there at the beginning of that, you know, Lady Death, Razor, She, all of those characters that came up at that time. And then there was probably like 6,000 others.
Yeah.
But, as
I collected
time,
all of them.
Yeah. As time went on, you know, the better books survived,
mm-hmm.
Whereas the books that were just kind of cashing in on what they thought was the craze really didn't survive.
Mm.
And, you know, the whole thing is when I published my Vamp Erotica number one, there was no bad girl craze. I was just trying to make a vampire comic.
Now, one quick question about that is it an adult book or is it just a, it's just a stronger girl type style comic?
No, it's adult. It is 18 and up. It is what I called rated R. Rated R. Not rated X, but rated R.
Gotcha.
And even from the very beginning, because we were a smaller company, I knew that I could not get, you know, let's say, because what happened is I would do most of the covers and I would do an 8-page story with Luxura, and then there would be other kind of like vampire stories in there, kind of like a cross between True Blood versus, you know, True Blood meets the Twilight Zone. And so every issue we would have three stories and some, you know, or two with a vampire story. And what I did was I sent out solicitations for writers and I had them to submit to me a 1-page synopsis of what their story is about. And I would get a lot of resistance from writers because they would say, well, no, I need more time and I need more pages. And from doing all of the editing that I did, literally hundreds of books at Personality Comics, I knew that if you could not communicate what your idea is for a story within 1 page, then 2, 3, 4, or 10 pages is not going to help you. So I would read every synopsis, and if it was for a good story, then I would go ahead and work with the writer and get it together. So the particularly the early issues have some great, great vampire stories that you know, were fun to put together. There was one in particular I remember. It was in I believe it was issue 5, where what happens is there's a vampire who he hibernated through a nuclear holocaust. And the world is kind of like wiped out. And so when he wakes up, the human population is reduced down to, you know, just like a pittance. So he realizes that he can't just arbitrarily and freely feed on human beings because the population is really dwindling. So he literally starts to help the human race to get better, which was, I mean, one of our writers came up with that. He just did a fantastic job. And
Human Farm.
Yeah, exactly. One of the great things that began to happen, and I mean, if you go back to 1993, 94, 95, is that I had a huge female readership. You know, based on the title and we're doing sexy girls, you would expect that it would be, you know, mostly males. But as I began to go out to conventions and do store signings, you know, time after time after time, tons of female readers would be coming up and be like, oh, I love your book. It's really different. It's not superheroes. I remember there was one retailer that he carried our books regularly. And he was like, he says, yeah, your book is the only book my wife reads. I got to bring her home a copy every time it comes out. Stuff like that I really enjoyed. I really, really enjoyed.
Well, that does tend to be a tendency Oh, good luck at that. In horror genre is a general rule anyways. I mean, more women are reading horror, more women are writing horror than ever before. And it's been kind of that shtick that's gone through.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We would I remember one time we were at a store signing in Pennsylvania, and this you know, woman comes in with her son, and you know, the kid goes over to one rack, and you know, the next thing I know, here she comes and she pulls out like the first 4 issues to get signed, you know, and I was like, wow. I said, you know, how did you find out about my book? And she said, well, I bring my son here every week. And she said, I've never been interested in anything. She said, but then I said, oh, well, what's this? You know, and I, you know, it's, and she started looking through and she said she really enjoyed the stories.
Nice.
So, that as a, you know, as a publisher, as a longtime artist, as a guy who's had a passion for this ever since the 4th grade, you know, that's the kind of stuff that really, you know, really makes you feel good, like you're doing the work that you want to do.
Cool. So one of the things that I like to explore with most people I have on the show is the evolution of things. How, like, you're talking the 90s when you started doing all this, and it's like, okay, that was a strong development point. Now we're in 2016, and I mean, the world has changed quite a bit in the way that we do things, like making comics, producing comics, distributing comics. Like, I'm being a comic guy in the side of the retailer side, I remember Brainstorm Comics being in previews, but I haven't seen them in previews in a while.
Correct. Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure it's because of the way that previews operates, DC and DC Direct or whatever operates that whole business, because they got all these kinds of things going on. So how, as a publisher in that style, how do you get the product out to market?
Well, I actually got out of publishing when the distributor wars hit their peak, which you as a retailer, you know about the mm-hmm. distributor. Okay, for anyone listening who's not familiar with the distributor wars, if you rewind to 1994, there's about maybe six or seven distributors, but there were three major distributors of comics in the United States. That is Diamond Distribution, Capital Distribution, and Heroes World. So what happened was that Marvel Comics got in a gobble up everything in sight mode, and they bought the number three distributor called Heroes World, and they removed their products from Capital Distribution and Diamond Distribution. What happened is it touched off what is known as the distributor wars of the 90s. What happened is DC Comics went exclusive with Diamond. Marvel was exclusive with Heroes World. Capital City had no one of any major size to be their distributor, so eventually the first one to go out of business was Capital Distribution. Mm-hmm. The people who bought Marvel discovered that they were good at making comics, but bad at distributing them.
Very bad.
Bad. Terribly bad. They almost sunk the industry single-handedly.
Mm-hmm.
When they got their wounds licked badly enough, they ended up going back to Diamond Distribution. And so when we were faced with three major distributors, we ended up with one, Diamond Distribution, who over the years have been the ones that have done about the best job in making sure the comic stores get their books, get them regularly, as best as can be done in any industry where you got to ship stuff all over the country.
Well, they, surprisingly enough, do a really good job of it for what they're doing. It's just sometimes they're weird.
Yeah. I mean, it's Diamond. They're a big company. They have, they've done well by the comic book industry overall, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
They don't control the content. They don't control the publishers. They move it from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is when I got in before the distributor wars, and then they started. And as the distributor wars were going on, the sales of my books just started to decline month after month after month after month. A lot of that having to do with the magical alphabet that exists in previews. And you know what the magical alphabet is. If you open up a phone book, you go A, B, C, D, E, F, G. If you you hit anything else. But when you open a Diamond Previews, it's D, M, and whatever else. Marvel has their own previews book now, so they're in there. What happens is there are certain group of publishers that are put at the very beginning because they dominate the market share. And that began in the 90s as a way to differentiate the large publishers. Whatever they did, they gave those larger publishers a premium spot. And I don't know if you remember. Do you remember that there were actually three categories in the Diamond Previews at the beginning of the distributor wars? There was the big people, Marvel, DC. Then there were the people who were who had supply agreements with Diamond. And then there were the select publishers, the people that they put all the way in the back.
I remember that. Yeah.
Well, to start off with, they stuck me all the way in the back because I had not finalized my supply agreement with Diamond yet. And so that very month, my sales took a hit. When I finally got everything straightened out, I got into the regular ongoing previews, but our sales just they began to decline, and a lot of companies went out of business, and I continued for a while until I got to a point where I realized, okay, I'm not able to make books at a quality level that I really want to make. It's getting too difficult. It's, there really is nowhere for me to go. So fortunately, while I was in the publishing business, I also had a printing business So I just left publishing and went into printing and did that for several years. Until sometime around in, I'd like to say 2000 and I think it's 2006. You know, I still owned the intellectual property to all of my stuff. I didn't sell it off. I still owned all of the, you know, the publishing rights and everything to
good man.
Yeah, I didn't sell it off like a few people that I know did. I did not, you know, just try to cash it out. I held on to it, and I got a call. I got an email from a company called Drive Through Comics, and I like I said, this is about 2006, and this is now before the iPad. This is before the Kindle, and they said, "Hey, we're starting an online digital download site, and you know, we want to know if we could put your books in there." And at that time, I swear to you, I said, "Who's going to buy a digital download? I mean, you got to have a comic book in your hand. Nobody's going to buy a digital download." And they said, "Yeah, they're in PDF format." And I was like, "Eh, well, all right." I was like, "Send me your paperwork." They sent the paperwork, gave it to my lawyer. Everything was in order. So I said, "Okay, well, I'll try it with two books." So I took like Vampirotica number one, Vampirotica number two. I put it into their system, and I did not expect anything to happen whatsoever. But being in business and being an entrepreneur long enough, there's one thing that I always live by, and that is you don't know what you don't know. So never dismiss anything until you've at least given it a try. So lo and behold, a month later, I get an email with a royalty statement. Yeah, they sold like $20 worth of books. But I was like, holy crap, people are actually buying downloads. And it really was an eye-opener to me. I, you know, and people who had never seen my work before, like around the country or around the world, because you yourself, you know as well as I do, you get a copy of Vampirotica, you can't stick it out on the racks right next to, you know, right next to X-Men.
Well, in my store, I can, because...
Well, maybe in your store.
I include a series called Zombie Tramp that everybody giggles at.
Yeah, I've seen that book. That looks really good. I got to read one.
Mm-hmm.
But what began to happen is, you know, eyes that had never seen my stuff before started, you know, checking the books out. And, you know, it just kept growing. So I own somewhere up in north of about 150, you know, comic publications. So I just started putting them on the system, and it kept growing and growing and growing. And I was like, man, this is amazing. And I'm getting fan mail of people who'd never seen my stuff before. And it kind of motivated me to start working on, you know, some new stories and things like that, which I started to do. And then, of course, you know, the iPad came around, the Kindle came around.
Yeah.
And most significantly, Kickstarter came around.
You see, and you're leading straight into all of my questions. I don't even have to ask the questions
I'm
going to ask. You're just going straight to them.
It goes right there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I literally had to, starting back in about 2006, I had to kind of train myself for a different world. So, I mean, I went doing tons of research. I was all over the internet looking into things, looking into printing, different types of printing that exist now. Regular offset printing versus print on demand, social media was emerging and growing, and, you know, it was social media became the equivalent of the comic store for me during these years. Because during the 90s and the early 2000s, the way that anyone found out about my book was they would, you know, breeze into a comic store, flip through the previews, might see my book, they might order it, there might be it in a back issue bin. It was the comic store. But seeing as how the distribution just got too difficult for us to handle, what happens is the internet became the comic store. The internet became the place where someone would be like, "Oh, Vampirotica, what's that?" Or, "Oh, who's this vampire chick with this crazy hair?" And
big hair.
Yeah, with the big hair, it's all over the place. Is it alive? Is it dead? What's her deal? And, you know, it literally began to grow and began to grow an audience. And I tried my first Kickstarter back in 2013. And I mean, it was successful. It was successful. Some people knew who I was, some didn't. And the first one I did, it raised like $5,000.
Nice.
And the second one did $12,000. And, you know, I still have my printing business, but I used the internet and Kickstarter and social media to grow new interest and a new audience in my books and my work. And since I have started from 2013 till now, I've published upwards of about between 25 and 30 new publications, all using Kindle, iPad, Kickstarter, a combination of all of that, putting that together and putting it out.
So I got a question, seeing as how we're on the Kickstarter phase. I always get, and when I bring up the question with Kickstarter for some people, is like, well, how do you use Kickstarter to produce a magazine or a comic book or whatever? It's like, don't you just get a bunch of people and they do stuff and then they put it all together and whatever? And from a lot of what I hear on how Kickstarter has worked to use these sort of things, it's as much a marketing scheme as much as it is to raise the capital to actually produce a product.
Kickstarter is a marketing platform. That's basically what it is. It's a marketing platform. You can work together with people or you can work on your own project. Kickstarter, you know, Kickstarter had the biggest innovation in crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. that I discovered is the secret as to why Kickstarter works. And Kickstarter, as you know, or for those who don't know, they have an all or nothing model, which is when you put your goal up of whatever that goal is that you're trying to raise, you have to raise all of it or you get none of it. And what happens is I actually discovered Kickstarter 2 years before I did my first Kickstarter. And I was looking at it and I was like, man, people are raising this money and they're putting out new comics. And man, this looks great. I've got to give this a try. So I went in and I actually started building a Kickstarter page for a project I was working on, which is the new Luxura story, Sword of the Apocalypse. And I started building the page and I was like, oh yeah, this is great. You know, and I was listing all this stuff about my illustrious history and comics and, you know, all that I've done and where I've worked and I've done this and I've done that. And I came to a point where I realized that I had put more effort into the Kickstarter page than I did in the comic. And I was like, okay, Kirk, back up a second. That's the pitfall that people fall into in mm-hmm. who have unsuccessful Kickstarters, either from the campaign or to get to the point where they haven't delivered what they're supposed to deliver, is that they're going in wanting to get all of this, but the thing that I believe is when you're doing a Kickstarter, you have to be the first investor. If you haven't invested a large part of yourself into a Kickstarter, then why should anyone else? You have to be your first investor. And if you don't have the money, then you better invest the time in your project. So I deleted the campaign that I was building, and then I backed up and I said, okay, let's go about this the right way. And so what I did was I went and I wrote my entire graphic novel. At the time that I did the page the first time, I'd written about half of it. So I went back and I wrote my entire graphic novel, 600 pages, and then I thumbnailed the entire graphic novel. And while I was doing that, I was blogging about it online.
Dude, I just have to say, 600 pages, that's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. It took me 18 months to write it. While I was going to work, while I'm raising my kids, you know, living my family life, I would wake up at like 4:30 every morning and I would write for anywhere from a half an hour to 2 hours every morning before I went to work. And I wrote the entire story. And it took me much longer to write it than to do the thumbnails. And then I went and thumbnailed the entire, all 600 pages of it. I did all the thumbnails because I wanted to completely work out the storytelling of what happened. And what it did was it forced me to craft the best story I've ever written in my life, because after I had written the entire story, I started discovering stuff like, oh, that sucks. That doesn't make sense. Why did you do that over there? You're going to have to move that chapter over here And there's no way that this guy would have done that by then. There's not enough time. So by doing it that way, I was like, wow, I really was able to find all of those mistakes that people who are just kind of writing as they go make and fix them. You know, things like, let's make the dialogue better. Let's make this fight scene better. Let's make this conversation better between these two characters. And so I did that. And then after I finished the thumbnails is when I said, okay, so how am I going to do about – how am I going to go? I said, tell you what, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do something called a chapter one. So I drew, penciled, inked chapter one, and I put together basically kind of an introductory book. It's got chapter one. It's got some drawings, some sketches. And I called that first Kickstarter, Kickstart the Apocalypse. It's me working on a new thing. And it was just for that 32-page book to introduce people to what I'm doing. And that, I had the entire thing completed before I did the Kickstarter. So I knew, I was like, okay, this will be a success because I've put the work into it. And when I go to show this to anyone who might be interested, I've got some real substance there. I've got something that I know what I'm talking about. I know that I believe in it. I've already invested, you know, literally about 20 months into it. Now, that was something that I was ready to sell, to go and say, hey, buy this. You're going to like it. It's good. It's a good introduction to what I'm working on. And the Kickstarter was successful, and I was able to rebuild new interest in Luxura as a character and get it going. Because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we've got too many creators who don't believe in what they're doing. You know, you got to believe in what you're working on. If you're not a person who's excited about the story that you're writing or the comic that you're drawing, then you're just doing it to whatever. You like to draw monsters or whatever it is like that. And you end up with stuff that falls by the wayside as opposed to stuff that will last.
The evangelist principle.
Yeah, exactly.
You believe it, you sell it. Anybody else, if they believe in it, they'll sell it too. But until you get to that point, bam.
Yeah, until you get to that point, bam. And, you know, it's funny. I'm on Kickstarter all the time. I'm checking it out. And I see a lot of people. And I'm like, no, you're not going to make it. You're not doing it right. You know, you really have to you know, and the thing that I say about Kickstarter is that Kickstarter will expose you.
Yeah.
If you're a creator, if you're sloppy, if you don't know how to do customer service, if you didn't really write your book, if you haven't drawn your book, if you don't even know how your book ends, Kickstarter will expose you for what you are. If you're just a huckster who's just trying to get money out of people because you think you can get a fast buck, Kickstarter will expose you for what you are, because there's no one between you and the customer to blame, the backer. And if you let down a backer, they will not come back. They will not come back and back you again.
And they will let everybody else know their opinions in a position.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They'll let everybody else know. I mean, even if, you know, and the backers are on Kickstarter, they are absolutely awesome. I've done about 12 Kickstarters so far. I've got some – there's a core of backers who they've been with me on every single one. And, you know, they've backed me. They know I'm not perfect, but they do know one thing. I believe what I'm doing. I'm committing to what I'm doing. And if there's a mistake or something's wrong or your book didn't get to you or anything like that, they know. They can send me an instant message and they're going to hear from me, like, if not that day, by the next day. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't get their book, they know they're going to get it. You know, I keep in touch with them. And you really have to be serious about what you're doing. If you're a bad business person, if you don't understand that doing comics is a business, like every retailer understands, if you don't understand that and you try to get on Kickstarter, you won't last for very long because people just will not buy your stuff.
You know? Keep taking all my lines. It's like a business. Yes, it's like a business. You, arg. No, that's fine. I'm cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, comics is fun to a lot of people until they realize, you know, this is a business. This is an industry.
Yeah, it's when you start separating the, hey, I enjoy doing, no, it's work. I got to work. Well,
yeah,
if you can make it happy work, it's happy work.
Yeah, if you can make it happy work, it's happy work. And
Cause,
you know,
the impression I get from you just talking with you for half an hour now is that not only are you enjoying what you're doing and enjoying actually putting out the merchandise that you're putting out, you have an understanding of the whole engagement process on the other side. It's like people who want to read this stuff, they want to enjoy it.
Exactly.
They want to move with it. It's not going to be earth-shaking, hey, I'm going to change the world or whatever, but it's enjoyment. And that's the whole point of doing most product, right?
Yeah, that's what it's all about. You've got to be wise enough to enjoy it, and you have to be wise enough to make enjoyable stuff for people to read. I mean, everything I've done has not been a success. You know, I've put some stuff out there that I thought it was going to be great.
And in any business, is any?
Right, yeah, and it doesn't sell. And then I'm like, oh, okay, well, that one didn't work. You know, thank you, Marketplace. I hear you loud and clear. Let me go back and retool and make some stuff that's more entertaining.
Exactly, and everything that comes in, and even if it fails and it sucks, guess what? You give it a little bit of time, you can turn that around to something good. DC does it. Marvel does it. All the other comic book companies I've ever read anything from have done it.
Right, yeah.
Although,
yeah.
Right now, both DC and Marvel are doing this weird, hey, let's reboot everything again.
Yeah, I know.
What?
I see some of the stuff that the big companies are doing, and sometimes I shake my head because it's like, guys, did you forget the 90s?
Yeah.
And, man, you're a retailer. You know, there's something that I see now, and it's like books with, like, 12 covers, 6 covers, 8 covers, 9. And I'm like, did you guys forget the 90s?
There's a comic book company and a particular title that has over 112 covers. And it's a title that was published 3 years ago, and they're still putting out variant covers for it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very short-term frame of mind.
It's a gimmick.
Yeah, it's a gimmick, and you don't build readership with that. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's readership. I'm an old time reader. I'm 51 years old. So, you know, I was reading John Byrne X-Men when they first came out, and I didn't care if, you know, there was not 4 different covers of X-Men number 94. You know, there was not 2 different covers of the Death of Phoenix. You know, we were just. You know, I remember, you know, at that time there wasn't even a comic store in my neighborhood. I had to go to the corner store that had a comic spinning rack.
Same here, actually.
And we would get off of the school bus, and before we go home, we'd head straight to the store because we knew the day it was coming out and just wanted that copy of, you know, X-Men or Teen Titans because we wanted to read what was going on, and we would do anything. We would cut grass. We, you know, hey, Mom, can I get some money if I do that? You know, anything to go and get those books. And if you write the stories, make stronger stories, get characters that people are going to love, you know, the books will explode. I mean, look at what Walking Dead has done.
Mm-hmm.
Completely story-driven, and it's in black and white.
Exactly.
One of the best-selling books in the industry.
And did you know that they put out a coloring book for The Walking Dead, or adult coloring book, for a series that's black and white?
Yeah, I know, right? It's already a coloring book, but now.
I just laughed my butt off when I saw that one. It's like, I'm bringing that in because I sold out of it already. So it was just, it's hilarious.
No kidding. Well, guess what? An adult coloring book is now on my publishing schedule because you are about the 5th or 6th person who has told me that these things are kind of cool. People are really into them.
It's so weird. It's if you get the right mix of people, the people who enjoy the artwork, say, hey, I could color. Well, maybe not as good as that guy did when he did the original, but I can have fun doing this.
Yeah, yeah. They're pretty cool. I saw one for, what is it? I think one of the Xenoscope books or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked pretty cool. It was really nice. It was pretty good.
You mentioned one of my favorite modern publishing companies, Xenoscope. I like them.
Yeah, those guys, they've done a pretty good job carving out a strong niche in the marketplace. There was when I was putting together one of my Kickstarters, there was a girl and her husband. They were working for me, and they were helping me to pack my first big Kickstarter, the one that did like 12,000, and I had a bunch to, you know, to pack and ship. And she was big into the Xenoscope books. It was like the only books that she bought. And I was like, you know, I'm always intrigued in the books that female readers are into. The reason being is, listen, you need a shot in the arm, increase your female readership.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a fact. I mean, look at what it does for the movies. Like, you know, Marvel gets a ton of money out of me because every Marvel movie that comes along, my wife and my daughter has to go see. You know, it's just no two ways about it. You know, they've got to see it. My wife and my daughter are fully aware of who Captain America is, Iron Man, Thor, the Hulk, all of these guys.
How about all the new ones coming out that aren't actually out yet?
I become the source of information. It's like, well, who's this Doctor Strange guy? What does he do? And I give him a brief, and you know,
that's
it's like,
a good
oh, okay.
one we're looking forward to.
I'll go there and see it, but it's amazing. I was talking to a good friend of mine who he owns a comic store here that I go to all the time, and I was talking to him and say, you know, there's a whole new generation of fans of these characters that have never read a comic book,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there's a part of you where says, well, wow, that's not good. But seeing the movies got my daughter into reading comic books. So it does work. It really, really does work. You know, well, particularly in the case of Marvel, what they're doing.
I've seen people saying, hey, the show was so great, Walking Dead. Do you have the comics? Like, of course, right here. Is there a way to read? Of course, the omnibus right here. Collect the entire story. Read the whole darn thing. See how different it is. Oh, that's so cool. It sells and it doesn't, but it's the same thing. It's
yeah,
the reverse side.
Yeah, Walking Dead has done a great job with their trade paperbacks. I think Image has done a phenomenal job with that. Those books are everywhere.
Oh yeah,
and they've been for a while. So you know, as long as that TV show is going, and for who knows into reruns and everything else, I mean, you'll be selling Walking Deads forever.
I expect at least for the next 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, and. By then, Walking Dead number one will be like, what, $500,000 or something? Like
it's currently $5,000 to $10,000 on auction if you can find it.
Oh, my God. I sold a copy of a first print of Walking Dead number one about a bunch of years ago when it was around $600. I didn't even know I had it. And, you know, the show was getting the comic and the show was getting popular, and my son says to me, hey, Dad, I think you have one of those. I said, no, I never bought that book. And he goes looking through my collection, and he's like, hey, I've got this number one. He's like, can I have it? I'm like, yeah. He goes, okay, I want to sell it because I want to buy some stuff. So he sold it.
Well, at least he's being enterprising.
He's being enterprising.
He's looking for where the money is at.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's
absolutely.
Good. So who would you credit as some of your influences for comic book making and art making and stuff?
Well, it goes – when I was growing up, it was, you know, the classic guys, John Byrne, Jack Kirby, John Buscema, Sal Buscema, those guys when I was growing up. When I became a student, I went to the School of Visual Arts, and my teacher was Will Eisner.
I was just going to say, that's cool as hell.
Yeah, that was incredibly cool. That was like that was the only reason that I went to the School of Visual Arts. I had found out that he was the sequential art teacher there. So I was like, okay, well, that's where I'm going. And so that was really one phenomenal experience. Will had a very simple way of teaching, but it was incredibly powerful. He would give us assignments. And he would say, like, pick your favorite movie and draw a 3-page adaptation of that movie. And he would give you the assignment. He would talk to you a little bit about what makes good storytelling, give you the assignment. Next week, everybody brings in their pages, and Will had a huge desk. It was like 8 feet wide. And what he would do, he would lay your pages out, and then all of the students stand around the desk. And what he does is he just goes through your pages and shows you what you did right and what you did wrong. And he would like have this kind of big sketch pad next to him. And he would like draw a little layout of how you should have done the storytelling. And then he'd give it to you. And he would repeat this process week after week after week after week until you really began to get it. And it was and of course he was Will Eisner. So he would, he would have industry people come into the classroom to talk to the students. So, you know, we come into class one day and Chris Claremont is there. And because Will can call anybody and they'll all come down there right away. And then we come in another day and Frank Miller is there to lecture the class for that day. And then we come, you know, the next week it's Scott McCloud. So, and this, I mean, it was just, it was incredible. And
got to tell you, I'm a little jealous right now.
You kidding, man? It was a great college experience. It was phenomenal. I mean, and on top of that, so, you know, every publishing company sent Will Eisner comp copies. They would send him like, you know, 30, 40 comic books a week. So I'm a college student. I don't have a dime to my name. You know, I'm scraping together $2 to have lunch because I'm going broke in art supplies. And so what Will would do is all of the comp copies that the publishers would send him, he'd just bring them to the class and be like, all right, here you guys, take these. So for my college years, my comic collection, most of it is free because I got it from Will Eisner's class because he would give them away to us.
I understand that completely because you were talking earlier about the distributor wars with Heroes World. Friend of mine was working there and said, here's a bunch of comics. Like, okay, what the hell do I need these for? And then I started collecting again as a result. It's like, I blame him for the, what, I'm not going to say how many comics I have over there now. That's actually one of the coolest things to go from. And I'm glad you mentioned Jack Kirby and your influences because I've always loved his work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There'd be no modern comics without Jack Kirby.
And that guy could produce.
Yeah, unbelievable, his output.
Sit him down and say, make some stuff. Yeah. It's like, okay, here you go.
I could never get close to what he was able to do on a regular basis.
I don't think anybody can anymore.
Yeah, no, not at the level of detail and creativity and ingenuity he would put in everything. It was amazing, but going on as time went on, I started to get into some guys I would enter in the industry when I was working for Personality Comics. We were working with Adam Hughes at the time. Very early in his career. And Personality also owned several other imprints. Personality also were the publishers of Spoof Comics. I don't know if you remember them.
I have a couple.
They've got these really nice Adam Hughes covers, Spider-Femme, Bat-Babe, Dare Dame. If you look in the inside cover in there, you'll see Kirk Lindo, vice president, chairman, blah, 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 blah. I'm in there.
Dude, that means I've got more of your comics.
Yeah, you probably have more than you realize. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, every once in a while I'm going through some old stuff. It's like, hey, holy shit, I remember. I know. Wait a sec, this artwork is familiar to me. Oh my gosh, I know. And that's the kind of cool thing I like going when people will bring in boxes of comics. Say, hey, what about this? And it's like, that's cool. That one's crap, but that one's cool.
Yeah. But Adam did some incredibly gorgeous covers, and he was and so you know I was you know I just loved his work, and you know I was you know at the time I was trying to learn how to draw females better. You know, I mean, that's like my stock and trade now. But back then I was like, man, I got to learn how to draw women better. And so, you know, and I was talking to Adam and he had said, well, hey, listen, I got a bunch of Xerox copies of sketches. So he sent me like a stack of like 50 Xeroxes from his sketchbook and stuff that he was working on. And, you know, just to show how to do stuff, which for me is one of the great things about comics. There's so many really cool, generous artists out there that really just want to help other people get going with their stuff. I mean, I love the comic industry. I've loved it since a kid. I'm loving it now. Like I said, I'm 51 years old. I feel like I'm just getting started. It is a blast. I consider it a real treasure and a blessing to be able to to be doing comics. It's fantastic. I mean, you have a comic store, you know. Mm-hmm. Every Wednesday is like Christmas.
Every Wednesday is Christmas.
Yeah,
every Wednesday. What am I getting? Actually, it's less that anymore because now on Friday I know what I'm getting. Sorry, on Wednesday I know what I'm getting next week.
Yeah, but then you get them on Tuesday, and then you can you get
the Wednesday. I don't do the quick ship things. I figure I don't need that. It's not necessary. Yeah. But this is cool. It's like I don't even have to ask you the questions because like the 30 questions I had a little bit over there, you answered them all already.
Yeah, sorry about that.
But there's one that you didn't answer, so I've got to go with it.
Okay, go ahead.
So apparently you did a movie adaptation of one of your storylines, and then you did a short which included Julie Strain.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I need to know more about that.
Okay, all right.
I've always liked Julie.
Okay, well, what do you want to know about, the short or the which one first?
Let's go with the short because I don't know the movie. I know the Julie.
Okay, so...
And she's
Julie
the perfect
Strain.
Thing for the Luxura as she shows up.
She was the perfect thing for Luxura. Okay, so how that came about is back around, I'd have to say maybe 1997 or 1998, my wife and I were at the San Diego Comic-Con. And, you know, we'd left our table. People were taking care of our booth for us. And so, you know, we're kind of walking around because I like to buy comics or, you know, meet artists and, you know, meet the people that I like, and I'm kind of we're walking around together, and you know I notice my wife kind of drifts away a little bit, and then you know just I kind of hear my wife talking to somebody, and she says, "You are just beautiful." It's like, you know what, you would be perfect for my husband's comic book. And I turn around, and my wife is talking to Julie Strain. Now my wife is like 5'6". Julie Strain is like 6'2",
and worth the climb.
And worth the climb, exactly. So my wife is there talking to Julie Strain, and I come over like, "Hey, how are you?" And she was like, "Kirk, do you know who this is?" I go, "Yes, I know who that is." And Julie Strain was just wonderful. She was like, "Hey, nice to meet you. What are you doing?" You know, I showed her some of my comics, and she said, "Wow, this looks amazing." She says, "Listen, I'd love to do this. This is really good." And I was like, "Okay, somebody pinch me." And she said, "Well, hang on." She's like, "You know, here's my contact information." She's like, "You know, once the convention's done, you know, give me a call and let's talk about it, see if we can make this happen." So I was pretty useless for the rest of the convention because, you know, that's the only thing that's going on in my brain is like, "Oh, shoot, Julie Strain. Okay, let me, you know, let me get my coolest voice on for when I go back to talk to her." But so I went back and then we, you know, called her later on, and then we kind of worked out the particulars. And she said, "Yeah." She said, "Listen, we can do a photo shoot out here in L.A. And she says, "I have a photographer that I usually work with. He has a great studio with like 15-foot ceilings. He's like, we could set up the whole thing here." She says, "And let me put you in touch with my costume designer because he does, you know, costumes, and he can probably do the costume." So she put me in touch with a guy by the name of Michael Bush. And so, you know, we straighten it out, get the costume done and everything. And I came to find out when I went out to L.A. for the photo shoot was that Michael Bush was actually Michael Jackson's costume designer. So I was like, so we're there and we're, you know, we're talking before the photo shoot and everything. And he said and actually what happened is Julie was talking with Michael, and Michael said to Julie, he said, "Yeah, Michael really liked these skulls." And I was like, "Michael who?" And he goes, "Michael Jackson." I go, "Michael Jackson, Michael Jackson?" He's like, "Yeah, Michael Jack." I said, "How do you know Michael Jackson?" He says, "Well," he's like, "Have you seen Remember the Time or this or that?" He goes, "Yeah." He says, "I make all of Michael Jackson's clothing and costumes." He's
nice.
Like, I've been doing it. I'm like, so wait a minute. I was like, Michael Jackson was looking at my Luxura skulls and thought that they were cool? He said, "Yeah." Which if you, you know, see the video, that's actually in the video. You know, he was saying how he liked the way that Michael Bush made the teeth and everything. So we did a photo shoot, which we videotaped. And, you know, it was really a fantastic experience. Julie Strain is one of the most wonderful people on the planet. She is a nice lady, a consummate professional. Fun to be around. It was an absolute blast. One of the highlights of my publishing career.
Dude, I'm getting more and more jealous.
Hey, listen, I'd be jealous too. It's you see why I love this stuff? I mean,
exactly. I mean, the opportunity to hit people with connections and stuff.
Yeah. You want to know about the time I rode in an elevator with Nichelle Nichols? That's another good one. You know.
Sure, go for it. We got four more minutes.
Nah, this is when we were doing Personality Comics, and we. Nichelle Nichols was at a comic convention. We did a comic with her. So we went there and showed her the comic, and she really loved it. And she said, "Well, come with me. I have to go upstairs." So I'm, you know, walking with Nichelle Nichols and, you know, getting – and she's like tiny. She's got to be about, I swear, 5 feet tall. And she was like, "Oh, this is wonderful. Do you put these books together?" I said, "Yeah, well, I'm the editor in chief and so on and so forth." So she wanted to purchase the original painting of her that was on the cover. So we were
nice. Able to
make that happen for her. It was cool. It was fun. For me, a guy who, when he was, like 10 or 11 years old, was sitting in the living room watching Lieutenant Uhura on TV. thanks to comics, I was able to get a chance to meet her. So it's wonderful.
You see, kids, comics can get you better in life.
Exactly.
Read comics, collect comics, make comics. It's the way.
But yeah, and that was a story about Julie. Wonderful, really, really, really cool. It was a lot of fun.
Well, when I read that on your webpage, it's like, oh no, we have to talk about that at least once. I don't care whatever other questions I have going. That's definitely one of them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what was great about that, which I cannot repeat, was, of course, Julie is in Hollywood, and she was able to tell me a ton of stories. She was telling me a ton of stories about big-name actors and actresses in Hollywood and some of the things that they do that I was sworn to secrecy that I could never repeat, but it is pretty eye-opening. It was pretty eye-opening, but it was fun. It was fun.
That was the main thing. So, as we're getting ready to wrap up, where and how can people find your stuff?
Listen, if you have a phone or a computer, you can find my stuff. You can Google Kirk Lindo. You can Google Vampress Luxura. I'm on every bit of social media, Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter. Probably the easiest place to start would be to go to vampressluxura.com. Or just, type Kirk Lindo or Vampress Luxura or Vampirotica in on Facebook and you'll find me. Easy to find.
Excellent. Cool. And do you have any big new plans coming out? Anything like special and spectacular and whatever that's just, oh, hey, that's cool.
The most special and spectacular thing will be I'm about two or three books away from completing reprinting all of my existing comic book properties, after which I will be embarking on completing the rest of my Luxura, the Apocalypse graphic novel.
Nice.
And that is the thing that is really, really the driving force behind me creatively right now.
Now, are you going to put an omnibus edition together and like put them all in one book? Sorry, two books?
You know what? Yeah, probably. Probably. I'm still trying to – okay, well, here's what I'm doing. I'm trying to figure out what's the best way to market it so that it will be at the right price point for customers to be able to get their hands on the story. You can't come out with a $40 book and expect that anybody's going to start reading that. So you have to – it has to be done in a way that you can attract the readers, make it affordable, make it something that's of value to them for the entertainment, and which I don't completely have that figured out yet, but I'm almost there.
Hold on. You're an artist, right?
Yes, I'm an artist.
But you're understanding all this business side of this equation. It's like, what the hell, man?
Yeah, that's kind of a thing that has been parallel with me throughout my artistic career, which the School of Visual Arts was very good at instilling in us, because the School of Visual Arts does not have professional teachers. They have professionals who teach. So
nice.
Right from the very beginning, you would have someone like a Will Eisner who understands what it is to, look, if you want to keep drawing comic books, you have to be able to sell those comic books. And so, that kind of started then. And as time went on, I made sure that I began to understand the business and consumer side of things and the readership side of things in making comics, from the retailers and what they need and things like that. At some point in the future, I'm pretty sure I'll be back in previews. I'm not sure yet. I want to make sure once I get in that I'm in there, I'm solid, the books come out on time and all of that good stuff that retailers and readers need.
Well, I'm going to look forward to that because I live and die by the previews distribution.
I know that. Listen, previews is wonderful. They get there every time. They make it so that you guys can stay open and keep making money and having fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been a hell of a good episode for me. I mean, I've enjoyed talking with you tremendously. I'm very happy you've come on the show.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm glad that Nancy Kilpatrick brought us together.
Indeed.
you know, if you ever want to do it again, let me know. I'll
absolutely. I'll happy to have you back anytime.
All right. Take care, and I'll make sure that I distribute your recording of the show, you know, around to everyone. Maybe you can get some of my people to become regular listeners of your show.
That sounds spiffy. Now, everybody in After Outland, you all have yourselves a good fun time. I think afterwards we have the spoon coming on. Have fun. Kirk, thanks for being a guest. Everybody else, be awesome.
Take care.
Of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their pick.